Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight, always a pleasure to talk to him, is writer, poet, cultural critic, Michael C. Ford. And we're talking about his latest book, The War Chamber Ministry.
Oh, okay.
Michael, welcome back to the show. It's been too long. I always love hearing your voice.
Yeah, we're on the air again.
Yeah, yeah.
People are probably saying, doesn't that guy ever shut up? Does he ever get writer's block? Or they say, not another book. What's with this guy?
Doesn't he ever get writer's block? Can you see what a curse? What a freaking curse that would be. Oh, my God. Hey, I got to ask you, talk to me about this War Chamber Ministry, because what's fascinating for me is it's poems from all over, from like recent ones.
I go all the way back to the first poem I ever wrote when I was 14 in junior high school. Because everybody else was choosing my room, my car, my house, my yard, my goldfish, my dog, you know. And I said, well, it was a couple of years ago, there was the Eisenhower pacified Korea. So I don't know what imp of the perverse was perching on my shoulder and whispering my ear at the time, but I just called it the Korean War, and I wrote my own, you know, my flash on it. And, of course, it was a rhymed poem because this math teacher who was teaching an arc of world poetry, that's all she knew.
Oh,
she was reading. We weren't getting Dylan Thomas and Denise Levertov and Kenneth Rexroth. We were getting the only American poet was Robert Frost, and he was very much in a rhyme time, you know, very, very much in the British tradition, which most American poets at that time were. So all I knew was rhyme, and that's what it turned out to be. It turned out to be a rhyme poem.
So what happened to you? What happened to you for writing this poem?
She gave me a D minus.
Are you And here it is.
You know, she said, this is very given to violence. And I said, well, you know, you're right. War isn't violent. It's cute and zany and fun.
You know. God.
You know, that's. But then I hated. Every kid in the room hated poetry after that night. I did too. It was just a couple of years later that I met Kenneth Rexroth, and my whole life, all of a sudden, there was an epiphany, and I said, modern poetry, okay, I get it. You know, and that was learning from one of the great writers in America at that time.
You know, Michael, can I ask you to say a few words about Kenneth Rexroth? Because I believe that a lot of people today have not a clue who Kenneth Rexroth was.
Well, they probably don't. He was a scholar and a painter and a poet. He once said that poetry is complicated and intellectual, and nobody reads it anymore. And he was saying that in 1959.
Wow.
So, you know, and so I said, well, what am I going to do? I want to do what you do. I want to read it. I saw him reading at the LA Jazz Concert Hall on the corner of Jefferson and Crenshaw, reading with Shorty Rogers and his Giants,
wow,
one of the premier West Coast jazz aggregations. And all of those guys were coming out of Stan Kenton's big band. They were forming small groups, spinning off of Stan Kenton's great instruction. And he presented that band with such majesty, you know, that you just couldn't help but realize, hey, something's going on here.
Wow.
You know, I heard him when I was 12 years old. I said, oh, my God, what is this? You know.
Back on. Okay, I love modern recording equipment.
I love modern technology.
Hey, Michael, I gotta ask you, too, because this comes up in the War Chamber Ministry. You also, so Kenneth Rexroth was sort of one of your first mentors, but so was
one. And then he told me, but he said, Kenneth Patchen is coming down from the Blackhawk. He's working with the Chamber Jazz Sextet, and he's coming down to L.A. He said, get with Patchen. It was his advice. It was Rex Roth advised to get with Patch, and I studied with him for 3 years. So
that's talk to me about that, because when I went to college, Kenneth Patchen was extremely well known. Almost every when I went to Clark, if you were anybody, you had a copy of some of Patchen's works.
Journal of Alvin and Moonlight.
Yeah, yeah.
The Bible.
I mean, he was for people who don't know, again, a huge and a very important poet of the time period.
Yeah, he was. And Rex Roth told me this great writer has even fallen out of favor because of his conceit against the very thing that I'm writing about in this book. And I even mentioned, don't I have a piece in there? There's a page where I say lines ending in a line by Kenneth Patchen.
That's right.
There's a page in there based on that. So, yeah, he was a great teacher, and I remember him telling me so many amazing things. One of the most important things he said to me is if you have an original approach to the art form and you have a unique creative imagination and an uncompromised integrity, you have 3 strikes against you.
Jesus.
And I never forgot. Of course, I'm living proof of that.
You are. You are.
His wife always said, "You poor boy. You're carrying the torch. You're going to end up like Kenneth." And the Patchens were wiser prophets, weren't they?
They really.
Am I writing this? Why? Several. Questions about this book include, why title this The War Chamber Ministry?
Right.
And it's been my contention that world governments, as well as international marauding military aggressors, and that includes the Japanese genocide against the people of Nanking, the Turks pogrom against the Armenians. It's been going on for a long time. And these people, these countries, seem to worship war like it was a religion. They are, in my opinion, ministers of war, aren't they?
They really are. And it's funny because as we're talking, the whole thing between Iran and the United States is... And when I look at this, I know you didn't plan it, but this collection of poetry about war and violence in the military-industrial complex couldn't be more timely.
But you would be amazed.
Yeah.
At how many of the university English department poets are pretending this book doesn't exist.
Really?
Oh, yeah. That's their essential occupation. They tend to be more comfortable teaching the infantile New Age poets writing ego gratification diary notes, those who write... what I like to refer to as Hallmark greeting card surrealism, and they're not poets involved in a noble and dangerous profession, are they?
No, and that's the thing. What you're doing, and we've talked about this in interviews past, because you don't necessarily like to be called a poet, because what you do is something different. It reminds me of what people like Laurie Anderson are doing. It reminds me, it's like combines performance and analysis and a lot of other things. It's sort of a step beyond poetry.
Yeah, I find myself, okay.
Go.
I think of myself as a kind of a reporter, that I'm
right.
A lot of what I do is reportage. So would it be accurate to say that I'm a cultural reporter? I think of myself sometimes as a walking newsreel,
Well, when you look at some of these poems go back many decades, and the issues that you're talking about are still with us. I found that really scary and depressing. That the things that these poems are concerned with decades ago, and then poems that you wrote right up until today, we're still dealing with the same issues. And that's really scary.
This might be a good time to read one of the ones that you highlighted, which is In Place of the Rabid Dogs of Democracy.
Okay, go for it.
I wrote this during the 2016 campaign because we had a choice between a sort of a lunatic fringe billionaire and an alleged felon. We had that, and I think a choice between those two people was a verdict against democracy.
Go for it.
So I composed this In Place of Rabid Dogs of Democracy, to whomever will plan to dishonor another American presidency. Vote for no one who supports ignorant genealogy, no one who would blast open space for our astrology, no one would corrupt with acid rains our climatology, nor encourage the warmongers of our pathology, nor strip mine the fertile gifts of our genealogy, nor bury salutary necessities of our petrology, nor poison the saviors of our ecology, nor drown civilian values of our hydrology, nor swim against the tides of our oceanography, nor would earthwards bulldoze our cartography, nor unearth the ecosystem trees of our topography. Will our new commander-in-chief of the free world, in opposition to the old dogs of democracy, truly be an anti-demo republicrat, green advocate, capable of protecting a vision of equality, and as no other in our national history, really listen to us puppies in militant barking protest against electing yet another harbinger of hypocrisy participating in a conspiracy to commit constitutional rape.
Wow. You know, it's always better to hear you read it than to read it yourself, because there's something about your voice that really brings this like alive. It's amazing.
Well, when writers look at the world in turmoil, they become sort of journalistic, don't they?
Yeah, you're right.
A lot of what I do is that cultural reporting. This is what's happening to our world. And
this is like an editorial.
Poets are writing about the pronoun I is dominant, and they're writing ego gratification diary notes, and it has nothing to do with the world. Did you read the quotes on that the publisher selected for the back of the book?
Yeah.
I mean, that's some guy at KPFA in Berkeley doing a review of the book said, I don't write about myself, I write about the world.
That's right. That's right.
I hadn't thought about it. You know, sometimes a writer doesn't think about those things in those words. Somebody else has to say it. Somebody else has to point it out, right?
Yeah. That's right.
And that's sort of it.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight, it's always a revelation to talk to him, is writer, poet, playwright, recording artist, Michael C. Ford. We're talking about his latest collection. It's really good. The War Chamber Ministry. It's extremely timely. Michael, there's a couple of things in this book I wanted to talk to you about. There's a whole collection. It's almost, as you mentioned, a separate chapbook called West Point. Talk to me about that.
Oh, yeah, West Point was a chapbook. And I corrected a lot of the damage of losing the Latin because people said people don't want to read Latin. It did have an inherent, role to play in that piece, and I finally got all of it down on paper, and this publisher at Four Hills Publishing has the courage to publish things like this in book form. You know, I mean, Michael is almost like a hero. He's been publishing Four Hills books for 34 years.
Wow. Wow.
And he's a guy who... have you talked to him yet? Have you had any kind of an interview with...
No, I was just going to ask you.
Well, he will. Yeah, he'll get you. You know, you guys will have a good time talking about things. Yeah.
But talk to me about these. What inspired these West Point poems?
Yeah, the idea was it was sort of an abstract view of the education of war. West Point is a college.
That's right.
So you're educating people as to the nature of war, and I don't know how much propagandizing goes on in there. I've never been in a classroom at West Point, but I thought it was interesting that I was back there. I was writing it on the campus of West Point, overlooking the Hudson River. You know, I was writing at that time, and that's how I did it. There's another section called 1960s damage.
Right.
And that has everything to do with the Kennedy assassination. His brother got blown up, and all of, probably an executive action. Sad to relate.
Could you? There's a poem that I had mentioned to you, the Dead Kennedys.
Would you like me to?
Yeah, I would.
Say that.
Yeah.
Dead Kennedys. I wrote this when I was touring with Jello Biafra, who had a band called Dead Kennedys.
I used to play them on the air all the time.
I wrote this, and then I read it at University of California, Fresno, and Jello was I was opening for Jello Biafra on that tour, and ended up at the Great American Music Hall in San Francisco. And where I read this again, and you'll hear it now, Dead Kennedys. Figure it this way. If you don't do anything, you won't make any mistakes. When Kennedy got his brain blown out of the back of his head in Dallas in 1963, the box office response was so impressive, they did a repeat performance at the Ambassador Hotel in 1968, and we discovered that the American dream had really been a nightmare all along. America woke up screaming and couldn't quit. You were never expected to appear on the cover of Architectural Digest, Mr. and Mrs. Front Porch, USA, bought a tract home in the suburban cliche tradition, but no dollars for food. She traded him in on a fully stocked Westinghouse. You can be sure if it's middle class. Especially when people ask, why is it you just can't get a job? And you tell them, poverty is hard work. But whenever they persist in reminding you about how many dues are necessary to continue your pursuit of happiness as a free citizen in America, the word America sounds lonesome as the drone of an old refrigerator on a warm summer Sunday afternoon. And, of course, that comes from a memory of being a child in my grandmother's kitchen, and all we could hear in the summertime was this drone, soft drone of a refrigerator, you know.
Jeez, that's an amazing...
And that's where that image came from. It just popped into my head, that memory. And
See, I worry that people today don't have enough history. As a matter of fact, some idiot in the Senate came out and said that he didn't think it was worthwhile studying history because it's already happened. That literally just was said a couple of days ago. And you read a quote like that and you just, I just don't know what to do with it. I mean, at this point, I'm in some kind of weird intellectual despair.
That's because think about it. National leaders are saying these things.
I know.
The mayor of Los Angeles at the time, Tom Bradley, doing the Olympics was happening. So my publisher at the time of a book of mine called The World is a Suburb of Los Angeles sent the book to the it's like casting pearls before swine. I mean, talk about that cliche, you know, and he sent the book. The world said, why don't you use this as a theme for the Olympics being in Los Angeles? The world is a suburb of Los Angeles. And Bradley's office wrote back saying, poetry is not an art form.
Whoa. Oh, come on.
Is that beautiful or what? I mean, that's what we get, man.
Holy crap. We're going to run out of time, but I want to ask, there's so many interesting...
We're running out of time.
Well, we are. But there's a thing that you
about something about the one point about the female warrior depicted on the cover of the book.
Yeah.
Was not an afterthought. In her 17th century military wardrobe, the abstraction of combat boots, a red velveteen waistcoat. I'm looking at the cover.
Yeah, yeah.
Without the sword. I said, no sword. No, she's got a sword to go with it. I said, no weapon in sight. She becomes a vision of female warrior who promises to fight for world peace. And I'm implying that we need a feminine center in the Oval Office, mainly because the men have been screwing it up for the last, 65 years?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I won't say anything further because it'd be begging the question, Mark. But well, hopefully readers of this book, if there are any, will get it that I wanted this book to be a testimony to a new era of voter awareness. Basically, that was going to be it.
There's so much in here. I wanted to talk to you we're going to run out. We have just minutes left, but you have a whole thing about Chinese poetry in here too.
Oh yeah, that goes without saying. I was thinking about Nanking and the whole genocide of that, and the Chinese people and then Red China and I've got a piece called in there called. There's no such thing as a good loser in Russian roulette.
The title alone is worth the price of admission.
Where I talk about playing red Chinese checkers. You know, there's a whole lot in this book. We could probably do 2 hours.
Oh, I know.
And we've only got 30 minutes.
This,
and I'm sure, you know.
And there's also, I have to mention that some of your big themes over the decades are in here too. Baseball and its relationship to the military-industrial complex.
Well, that, of course. In 2004, the Mayor's Office of Cultural Affairs invited Terry Cannon, who was the founder of the Baseball Reliquary in Los Angeles, to produce an evening celebrating the Brooklyn Dodgers' move to Los Angeles to become Dodger Blue. Now, there were many in 1957 who didn't consider this a celebration at all.
Oh, yeah.
They more like considered it to be a funeral. So my 4 pages of narrative poetry, which are much too many pages to recite now because there's no time, but it was implied that those feelings... It just happened that pro baseball metaphorically aligned with U.S. government evolution.
Wow.
Don't you think?
I think so. But you're the first person that
baseball became a metaphor. So while people might enjoy reading about the Brooklyn Dodgers, and if I've got time to say a brief story, by the way, I'm reading. This took place in an amphitheater across the street from Hollywood Bowl. So I walked out in front of 250 Dodger fans, you know, and I drop a baseball shirt over the music stand that says Brooklyn Dodgers on it, right? So I thought I was going to think people would boo me right off the stage. And I read the piece and I finished it. And seven people in the front row stood up and gave me like a standing ovation. And I said, wow, why did you guys do that? And they said, we're from Brooklyn.
That's right.
So that was it. So I was appealing to people without even realizing it.
I also want to mention you have Susan Hayward.
Writer wishes you could do that, right? I mean, to touch, emotionally touch a chord like that.
Well, first of all, that's still heavily felt in Brooklyn out here in the East Coast. That's still a heavy-duty thing.
People, of course it is.
They never forgot that. They have not forgotten that.
There's an obvious negative history between the Eisenhower years when the Dodgers were playing in Brooklyn to when they migrated to the Coliseum in Los Angeles. And I believe that the disintegration of an American political system, along with the gradual corporate ripoff of Major League Baseball, were very easily connected.
We're completely out of time at this point. And you're right.
We could be talking. Hear that?
Yeah, I did.
I hear what you said.
We're completely out of time. My returning guest tonight is writer, poet, playwright, recording artist, Michael C. Ford. We've been talking about his latest book, The War Chamber Ministry, Pick It Up. Michael, it's been a pleasure as always.
Always, yeah.
You're listening.
Good talking to you, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.